Support for Best of Belfast comes from listeners just like me who love Northern Ireland and believe we have a better story to tell. Massive thanks to all of you listening who have already joined the Producers Club, especially our Titanic producers, Barclays Eagle Labs, Ulster University, Young Enterprise Northern Ireland, Gavin Wall, Peter Dixon, and of course, the Ormobiles team. To find out more about how you can support independent ad-free media, get invitations to live podcasts and submit questions to our guests, please visit bestofbelfast.org. Thanks so much, and we really hope you enjoy today's show.
Well, folks, how are we? Welcome back to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. Still stuck here in my mother-in-law's basement here in Germany. The Christmas trip turned into quite the palaver. But, you know, the show must go on, as they say. And thanks to the wonderful powers of technology, it's actually possible to make it happen. This one's really cool. Like, this was a really, really fun one. It was recorded live as part of the Cathedral Quarter's Out to Lunch Festival, which was really fun to be a part of. Something a bit different for us. And more importantly, gave us the chance to sit down with someone who, no joke, has been sitting on the want to interview list for, I'd say, probably about 2 or 3 years. I remember in the olden days, as we'll call them now, when we could be in like pubs, you know, remember that? I remember sitting in the Jaggy Nettle with Jerry White, Jawbox Jerry, as we call him, sitting around, I think it was wintertime, sitting by the fire. And I was like, Jerry, you know everybody. Like, who do I need to talk to? And Jerry said, you need to talk to Martin Lynch. So, Martin Lynch is a playwright from Belfast. He was brought up in the docks areas, and he started out in community theatre at Turf Lodge in the heart of West Belfast before going on to be appointed the resident playwright at the Lyric. Across the last 35 years, Martin's work's been produced in many parts of the world, including the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, Brighton Festival, the USA, Romania, Russia, Canada, and Australia. He's also written many plays for The Beeb, BBC Radio 3 and 4, and co-wrote the screenplay for the Sam Goldwyn film A Prayer for the Dying, which starred a few, you know, small-time names like Mickey Rourke, Bob Hoskins, and a fella called Liam Neeson. Martin's recently been elected to the Irish Association of Artists, Is Donna, whose previous members include Samuel Beckett, Seamus Heaney, and Brian Freel. The episode you're about to hear, we cover a whole bunch of stuff. It is incredibly fast-paced. We only had 45 minutes to an hour, so we had to go incredibly quickly. And I'm impressed. You know, we got further than I was expecting. Martin's the kind of guy who I would love to sit down and do, you know, like a five-hour podcast with. And actually, a lot of people who tuned in live, they were like, oh, mate, you got to get Martin back on the show again. You got to do a live podcast in the John Hewitt or something whenever the world opens up again. And I'm like, yeah, I'm all for it. If Martin's up for it, I'm up for it. But in the little kind of 60-minute slice you're going to get, we talked about what it was like growing up in a house of 12. We talked about his first jobs. He was a cloth cutter. He was a dock worker. We talk about the thread that runs through his work of articulating the working class voice and why that's important to Martin. And a whole bunch of crazy stuff kind of from history. We talk about pet lions. We talk about the neighborhood. We talk about stealing books from the bookshops and bits of paper to write his plays. Just so, so, so many really interesting stuff of a Belfast that I didn't experience, but a Belfast that I love to hear stories about. So yeah, look, that's it. Really hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for being here. Had an absolutely class time with Martin. And I hope you enjoy spending this time with us as well.
Yeah, I grew up in Moffat Street in the Docks area, a one up, one down. I heard Michael Caine talking one time on TV saying he grew up in poverty but in a two up, two down. I says, you're a lucky bastard. And there was like 12 of us all in the one house. You know, I'd like to ask my dad now if he was still alive, what was he playing at? But my earliest memory is putting my hand up to the table, which was in front of the window leading to the street, and to get a bit of Belfast bop. Fantastic. That's my earliest memory.
So 12 in the one house. What was that like?
Well, there was 8 slept in my bed.
Slept me.
And if you wanted to turn, somebody shouted, right, everybody turn to the right. Everybody turned to the right. And as our Brian always says, my brother, he says he learned to swim at the shallow end. So having, you know, also the toilet seat, an outside toilet. And you'd think that that was a bad memory, but there was always someone that had been there before you. Even in the winter, it was always warm.
That's so great. You know, there has to be some perks.
There's a great advantages of a large family. Great advantages. I mean that, you know, of a comradeship and stuff like that.
And I assume, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, your family wasn't unique in the neighbourhood and there being so many?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There was the Jennings up the street, of which there's about 10. Kelly's across the street, about 7 or 8. The Brady's in Henry Street had about 24. And of course, the old myth that we were the mixed district, Catholic and Protestant. I grew up in a Catholic background. The old myth that Protestants didn't have big families. There was 19 in the Doak's house. right across the board, working class people just didn't have a handle on controlling their willies and their lives. You know?
So talk to me a bit more about the neighbourhood, because, you know, that whole part of the city has changed tremendously and it keeps changing very, very dramatically. And, you know, as someone, I've embarrassed myself here, I was born in 95, so the Belfast I know is very different to the Belfast you've lived through. You know, you just hear stories, and to me all it is stories. You hear, you know, that part of the city, like you've already mentioned, was incredibly diverse, not just Protestant and Catholics, but lots of people that were connected to the ship industry. You hear stories of fellas walking pet lions down the street. You hear all sorts of stuff. So, you know, what was the neighbourhood like, even historically, and the neighbourhood you experienced?
Well, York Street pretty much started in Belfast city centre. It started where the Belfast Telegraph offices are, you know, just there at Royal Avenue. The continuation of that is York Street, where the Art College is now, where the new college is. And that went right out to the shore, as it were, right along to York Road, which went right down past Crusaders Football Club. So if you start in the city centre area, it was a mix of wee villages. The first one on the right-hand side coming from Royal Avenue was the Half Bop. Mm. That's where Cathedral Quarter is now, where the Mac is and all that stuff. You had Edward Street and those other wee streets. Then staying on the right-hand side, you had Little, which was the bottom of Great Patrick Street, Garmoyle Street, Tomb Street. And that was full of Italian. Not when I was growing up, it was only a few Italian families left, but that's where the Italians came at the turn of the last century and lived there in droves and then spread around the city and filled a field. Antoinette Morelli, the actor, is from that part of the world and so on. Then if you cross the road again, you're in the R district, which was the Barrack Wall. Mm. Named so because of our British Army's artillery barracks built in 1848 or something like that.
Wow.
And it had a big surround of a big high natural stone wall, which ran right along the length of a good part of North Queen Street. Then back over to the other side of York Street again, you're into Sailor Town. And that sort of like started from Nelson Street, the Half Bop, right down to the docks, right down to the water. Then you cross over again and you're in Taggart's Bay, where the writer Sam McAutrey came from. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he wrote short stories and a few novels. So all those wee villages and the whole Catholic and Protestant thing was weird, because in the Barrack Wall, for instance, the Catholics were more towards the top end of the street, maybe about 6 streets. Top end was Catholic, and at the bottom end were Protestants.
Right.
And by and large, there was a couple of big, the 1935 riots, sectarian riots, were actually fought in York Street, in our district. And the War of Independence, or the creation of the state, 1921-22, again, York Street carried the brunt of all the violence. In fact, my grandfather, Charlie Harvey, was shot dead by a Protestant sniper.
Wow. And
as he walked through all the yard walls, had a hole in them, cut so people could go down the street. And when he was walking through that and came out the other end at Union Place, he was shot and died in 1922.
So what sort of stuff would you have seen as a boy? You know, because I imagine you just didn't stay all day cooped up around an Xbox and the one up, one down. I imagine you just were out traveling about, exploring. You know, what sort of things do you remember about that?
Well, the main thing was the football street, which was North Hill Street, which ran at the top of all our streets. And we paid, like, you went to 10 o'clock mass when you did go to mass and when you were a Catholic. you went to 10 o'clock mass, got out about a quarter to 11, and then we picked teams, two teams of however many was there, 20 a side or whatever. Using the lampposts as goalposts, you played till about 10 or half 10 that night. It was dark. You went home for your dinner, got your dinner and came back out and the match was still on. You know,
and what sort of dinner was mum putting on the table?
It would have been a bit of chicken and potatoes and some vegetables with, always, believe it or not, a bit of jelly and custard for dessert.
Nice one.
So that would have been. When we went, we all had dogs, right? So I had a dog called Rocky. The gyms has had a known mutt that was half alive and half dead called Shamrock.
Lucky.
Rebel. We had about eight dogs, and we used to go up the Newsboys Club, which I went to, which was a big part of my childhood in York Street, where I played football and boxed and table tennis and Scottish dancing, would you believe?
Wow.
They had a cottage along the Laggan across the river from the village of Edenderry. And so you went there at the weekends. So you know, these ruffians from York Street had to go up in the Malone Road bus and then walk through Barnett's Park, top of Malone, and along the Laggan to Dixon's Cottage. So when we weren't going there with the Newsboys, we would have went up there ourselves with the dogs. And our dogs were streetwise and fought, and they'd have been eating poodles and sausage dogs and stuff like that to the horror of their owners.
Crazy.
On the other end of North Belfast, we went to the Alexander Park, the Grove, and then the Cave Hill. Spent a lot on the Cave Hill.
Wow. How long would it have taken you to get there from your house?
Oh, well, you got the bus. And yep. It lifts you off at the bottom of the zoo steps. And there used to be steps up.
Oh, wow.
So you get off there and then you just ran free up the vehicle. And sometimes on the way down, broke into the zoo from the railings and did a tour of the zoo.
That's unbelievable. So, I mean, what was your first job? Do you remember?
Yes, my first job. I left school at 15. In fact, I left school around my 14th birthday because I was to leave. My birthday's on the 22nd of November, and I was to leave that Christmas, you know, leave in December. And after my birthday, I just said, fuck it, I didn't go back to school. So my first job was at Noble's Bag Store, as we called it, Bag Store. Right. And I was a big yard in the half pop where they cleansed old fish bags and fish bags from the docks and resold them. It was the dirtiest, filthiest thing.
Flip me.
Then I went to work with McHugh Dick's Timber Yard down the docks down Duncrew Street and pulling wood off a machinist at the other end and stacking it. And then I got somebody said to me, I went to the Youth Employment Service, which there was at that time, and I got coaxed or diverted into cloth cutting. And I became a cloth cutter for 4 or 5 years of serving time in Pottinger's Entry. And
yeah, wow.
Yeah, a wee doorway there just beside.
Aye, there's always a fella busking underneath it usually because of the echo.
Aye. Well, yeah. Our doorway was next to that, in between it and the bar. What's the bar? The Morning Star.
Aye, that's right.
And you went right up to the top where our factory was, making jeans and boiler suits and things like that. And I did that for 4 or 5 years.
So how does you know, a teen or a mid-20, you know, guy then stumble in the theatre? I'm going to make an assumption. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it was common, but, like, were loads of people around you going to the theatre or into writing or into the arts, or was it looked on as, what are you doing that for?
The only theatre I knew up until I was 26 was the Mater Hospital's operating theatre, where my dad where my dad had an operation for pains. Nobody around our way went to the theatre. Nobody was an actor. Nobody was an artist. Nobody was anything. It was completely philistine in that sense. There was obviously people who played music. There was guys who were in bands, and Tucker Kelly across the street from us was on 6-5 Special, Top of the Pops of the Day, 1960-61, singing, you know. So there was a lot of music or musicians about the place. But the theatre, no. First time I ever heard of the theatre was our aunt came back, probably about 1970 or 71, came back after seeing James Young.
Oh, wow.
You ever heard of James Young?
Yeah, yeah.
He's an early actor and comedian who did one-man shows in the group theatre. And she would have said, just, you know, we laughed all night. That was the first time I ever heard of the notion of theatre. What happened then was that by the time I was 20, the Troubles had broken out. Mm-hmm. And we had moved in the meantime to Turf Lodge, sunny Turf Lodge on the hills of the Black Mountain, on the side of the Black Mountain. And the Troubles, the first weekend of August 1969 was the biggest shock of my life. Mm. And it was for loads of people. I was 18, and suddenly whole districts were getting burned, people shot. And that one weekend, there was 6 people dead.
Flip me.
And that might seem like nothing now, but at that time, remember, at the weekends, I was going to the dance halls, and I thought I was Stevie Marriott out of Small Faces, or Mick Pender out of Searchers, and I was walking away with leaving girls home all over Belfast. And then suddenly this life, remember, this is just the end of the 60s. This life was turned upside down. There was buses across the road on fire, buses that used to sit on to go up the road. And that was just exhilarating and extraordinary. And at the start, I loved it. Anything that broke the routine and looked like it would be good fun, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
So that during that then, I didn't know at that time, but my two brothers were already in the Republican movement and had been since the mid to late 60s. Because in those days, the IRA was a secretive organization and very, very, very small. And but in 1969, after the first outbreak, they couldn't cope with the recruits. People went flying into the IRA. And I applied to join the IRA with my older younger brother. And I went to a couple of classes, induction classes, and I dropped out because I didn't like the notion of violence. I didn't want to. I was streetwise in the sense that I grew up in York Street and I could fight or defend myself.
Yeah.
The notion of a gun, which was so definitive and probably final, I dropped out. But then it just got worse and worse. Within a few months, the false curfew came. I don't know if you know of all this stuff, Matthew, but they were pretty heavy-duty, violent communal upheavals. And then internment came out. Internment came out on August the 9th, 1971. And that was the end of normal life in Belfast. Because even between 1969, when I was, when the first violence happened, I was still leaving. I left the girl home to Canberra Street up the Shankill. And she brought me round to her ma's house and then round to an empty house that they'd just bought or removing. So I was walking around those districts. So some semblance of normal life reoccurred in 70, 71, yeah, up until internment week. And internment week just changed everything. There was huge numbers of people on the streets running around, you know, just going buck mad. Our estates just became violent places. Mm-hmm. And after that, it never stopped. So I then joined the IRA around 1971, just before internment came out, because I'd been reading, you know, Marxism, Leninism, all the revolutionary writers of the time.
What turned you on to that? How did you get even a hold of that, or what made you check those out?
Well, it was really the Republican movement. Our Eamon was telling me about a conference he was at where he said the movement's going socialist. And I said, this is during the dark in bed at night. He's in one bed and I'm the other. And I said, Jesus Christ, the movement's going communist. I better tell my mama. And then I was on the top of a bus going down the Falls Road. And there was a group of people writing things on the wall, housing, not violence, housing, not flats. Divis flats had become a big issue. And I said, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do. I want to be politically active. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then you discover that in something is what would you call it, macho as the Republican movement, being simply, I joined the political wing, which was the Republican clubs in those days, and I was active, but other people in the IRA didn't take me seriously when I wanted something done. I went with a campaign against the Good Old Age Pension or something in Turf Lodge. Mm-hmm. I was just dismissed.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when you read Lenin and, you know, What Is to Be Done, his famous book, his view was that you need to be armed. Mm-hmm. You need to take power and take control. Mm-hmm. And around that time, that's what I decided to do, and I joined the official IRA, which was different because there was a split at that time.
Yeah. So at what point did your interest in words come about? That might seem things that seem like an odd thing to say, but just whenever you're talking about even seeing the stuff written on the walls, you know, we all see that stuff. Some of us take note of it, some of us don't. Did you always have that kind of bend towards the written word? You know, I imagine not everyone's in their bunk at night in the dark reading Marxism. Like, you know, where did that come from?
Before all of that, before I was going down to Gardner's and standing in Gardner's bookshop and reading half, well, not half, a quarter of What Is to Be Done over 2 hours standing in the bookshop. I had no money to buy books. I ended up starting to steal a lot of books in those days for my education. Other kids were at Queen's or somewhere else. I was in Gardner's bookshop, stealing books. But here's what is the great thing. At this point, I need to talk about my father. My father was a dock laborer who didn't want to work. So we didn't get a great upbringing. He didn't work that much, but he read, and he was very knowledgeable, and he read, and he read, and he read. And told stories late at night. He was a great master storyteller, as a lot of dockers are, because of always starting in from the rain or no work. So they gather together and they tell stories. And you learn things like a story has to have a start, has to have a middle, and then it has to be a punchline. Any docker can do that to this day, the older ones. Whereas you still get a lot of people telling stories who don't know that frame and can't do it. But my father was a master storyteller, and he would get up in the middle of the floor and he'd act out different people around our way. Now, this man's a docker. He's 6'2", built like, you know, Sonny Liston or Frank Bruno. Big, big man. And I'm going to write a play about him, because his essential issue was that he was writing poetry and getting it published in the odd magazine.
Wow.
And he was reading poetry. Like, you'd go to his bedside and there'd be Yeats or Patrick Cullum or maybe Wordsworth. Now, in our whole district, that wasn't going on.
Wow.
I knew very quickly that my dad was the only one doing that. There used to be a thing about lending books in those days, Matthew, where about 10 o'clock at night, he'd fold three books together by the leaves, you know, and attach them all to each other. He says, now, Owen, get me some books. Go up to Mr. Cabinet and then go to Robbie Baker or go to this one. And then I'm at the door and he'd say, and write, no cowboy books. Because a lot of the men in those days in the 40s and 50s and 60s read these cowboy books, which were wee thin, mostly photographs.
Yeah.
Or a lot of photographs or drawings. And of course, my dad wanted something substantial to read. Mm-hmm. Like I remember him taking me down to the Central Library, which was very close to us. And I'm holding his hand, and I could hear him tutting and muttering. There was no books that he could read.
Wow.
Because all the ones in the sections he was interested in were the same, and he'd read them all, and he was waiting on the new intake.
That's cool.
So a ferocious reader and a great storyteller. So I found myself, Matthew, when I was 16, 17, starting to write poetry. Not because, I mean, I didn't even think of my father or that he had written poetry in the 50s and stuff like that. I was just, I don't know where it came from. I just started doing it. When I went to the Orpheus ballroom and you left the girl home and then you arranged to meet outside the GPO, which is where Castle Court is now, that was a favourite meeting place. If she didn't turn up, which sometimes happened, that was four poems.
Hmm.
You know, when you were depressed or annoyed or
down. Yeah. It's great material getting dumped.
Yeah, essentially that was it. So I used to write a lot of poetry. Then when I was 17, we were all watching Top of Pops in John McAvoy's house. And I remember well, it was the Rolling Stones. So that's about, I don't know, 60, 67. Told you once and I told you twice. Mick Jagger was a great showman and we all looked at each other and I knew what we were all thinking. We could do that.
Mm.
So we all went downtown and bought guitars and hired purchase.
Unbelievable.
And only two of us kept at it. John the Peer played a bit and he ended up in folk groups. And I played it then for the rest of my life. So I started writing songs. And I remember in the late 60s, right into the 70s, probably wrote 200 songs.
My goodness.
So that creativity was there at that time.
Yeah. So how did you go about honing that? And I say that kind of with a bit of hesitation, because I think there is kind of a big movement where now I think a lot of people my age, myself included, I'm guilty. It's like, okay, I need to do a course on creative writing, or I need to go and do this masterclass, or I need to go and have someone tell me how to do it versus going out and just doing it like you did. So what was there ever a moment where you're like, okay, I need to then start sharpening this, or did you just keep doing the repetitions until it worked?
Matthew, this is mad, and when I think about it, it gets even madder, you know. I saw two plays.
Right.
1975, I was OC of Turf Lodge. I was also on the battalion staff. And we were told by the office downtown that a play was coming up from Dublin and we had to put it on.
Okay.
I was given the job of putting it on other centres around Belfast, including Queen's University. And it was a play by John Arden and Margaretta Darcy, who I'd never heard of in my life. I don't know if you know them. John Arden's one of the angry young men from the Royal Court in the 1950s and 60s, who wrote Sergeant Musgrave's Dance and other plays that were done regularly. Margaretta Darcy is a mad, Galway woman who brought him to Ireland. So they'd written a play about the life and times of James Connolly, and it was my job to put it on. At that time I was full-time organizer of the Republican clubs on £14 a week.
Wow.
So plus getting £14 on the dole, doing the double, if you might say. And we got it on all the centres. The only problem was it lasted for 18 hours.
Oh.
If you've ever heard of it, the Nonstop Connolly Show is a great, great project. So at Queen's, we put it on for 18 hours. You had to bring a pillow and a lunch and all that stuff. But I didn't go to watch it anywhere because I was annoyed to some extent that here we are working for the revolution. And the command staff in central Belfast or the headquarters in Dublin wanted me to organize a play.
Yeah.
A play. That was a bit out of the way. However, so John Arden came up to Belfast and I brought him round to my house and him and my dad sat and talked for 3 or 4 hours. And then the two of them, Arden and Dorsey, then walked around Turf Lodge in costume with placards and all, with the other actors. There's about 4 or 5 actors drumming up support for the show that night. So that night, it was on in Turf Lodge, and I thought, well, I better fucking be here. So I stood at the bar with the rest of the men, and about 100 people turned up, mainly women and children. And I remember the first lines of the play. John Arden's son was in it. And it was, the work was hard, but the pay was, the work was hard and the pay was poor. I just remember those two lines. And he was scrubbing a floor at the time, John Arden's son. So then there was things like, he starts telling the story of Connolly, but started off with the Land League and all that stuff. And suddenly there was 5 actors, and instead of being in costume, they just put a coat on or a hat on to become a militia, or another hat on to become a peasant. And that's the way it was. And I'd never seen anything like this before. So suddenly, after standing at the bar talking to the men about other things, I kept getting drawn to the play. And then this guy jumped off the stage and ran through the audience, chased by English yeomen with blunderbuss and letting off these sounds like guns. And the place was electrified. Electrified. Everybody cheering the bandit, the Land League bandit, against the English yeoman. And I remember the English soldiers are walking about round the door, round outside the front door of the club, coming into it a lot. And that was accelerating. I didn't really realize it at the time, but I was telling a guy about it the following week in the club called Desi Murray, and he says, there's a play on the Lyric Theatre you might be interested in, We Do It For Love. And I says, where's the Lyric Theatre? And he told me where it was. And myself and my wife then, we went to see it, and I loved it as well. But walking down the stairs of the Lyric, I remember saying to myself, back to the stuff again, Rolling Stones. I'll do that. And I have more to say than what's in that play. And I went home. No, I went down to Gardner's first and stole a big writing pad. They gave 4 writing pads. And I wrote the first play sitting up in bed over about 6 weeks. And I wrote about the 1932 hunger rats in Belfast, which my dad used to endlessly tell stories about. And because I had a lot of influence in the district, I was able to solicit people or order them into the play. So if I had a character like Jackie Wisdom or John Gibson, instead of me making up a character, I wrote the dialogue and the action around how he would behave.
That's brilliant.
Probably all he could do. And I was in the play myself. In fact, I think I played the lead part, and that was the last time I ever did anything like that.
Nice.
But we got an audience, and the audiences loved it. And then we did a few more plays that I'd sat up and wrote late at night and put them on in the local club. And people were loving them, and I thought, fuck, there's something in this, and it'll keep us going. And that's how the whole thing started. I mean, sorry, just one of the things I try and remember all the time is when I was watching the John Arden play, the thought struck me that these people on the stage were able to make me feel angry, excited, laugh, think. Actors were pretending to be other people. They knew, I knew, they knew, and yet it still worked. And so from those two plays, I wrote my first play. Like, that's just, that is mad when you think of, you know, people do 10-year courses or writing stuff. And I just actually structured them the same way as we do it for Love and my first play, We Want Work, We Want Bread. I just structured them same as Arden's show and Nonstop Connolly's show, you know, fast moving songs, action, and it seemed to work.
It's incredible. So talk to me about sitting up in bed writing. Is that something that stuck? Is that a practice that kept going?
Well, not necessarily sitting up in bed, but I'd been used to writing poetry over the years. I had poetry published in the teens in the City Week magazine, so the writing thing then had taken off from I was 16, 17, and I was wanting to write. What happened then was the Republican Club's Advice Centre in Turf Lodge had a typewriter. So I used the typewriter to write the plays. I took it home at nights and used it. The other thing was I had no money to put on the play. Somebody, Bernard Cullen, lives nearby, and he'd been acting at the Lyric Theatre as an amateur. I think he was in some professional shows. And he says, apply to the Arts Council. So I wrote into the Arts Council for money for to put on We Want Work, We Want Bread. And I got a letter back from somebody called Michael Longley telling me that we don't put on plays by unknown playwrights. We don't put on unknown plays by unknown playwrights, but get in touch with Marie O'Malley at the Lyric Theatre. Now, of course, Michael Longley has since become a great supporter of mine and proposed me for S. Dana, which I've just got into and has been fantastic in my career. So I went to Billy McNum, who was OC of the command staff in Belfast, down the falls. I says, Billy, I've written a play. I want to put it on and I need some money for it. He says, what do you need? I says, about £50. This is 1976. He turned around to a woman called Kitty O'Kane who looked after him money, and he says, give him £50.
Unbelievable.
No discussion, no debate. So my first play wasn't funded by the Arts Council. It was funded by the official IRA. And only playwrights have that start.
Oh man, that should be in your bio. You know, that should be your opening line. That's crazy. If you know there was if the movie trailer version, that would be how they would open it. You know, the shock and horror of it.
Yeah,
class. So you know, we've talked a few times about how you know kind of the thread that runs throughout a lot of your work is this desire you have to articulate the working class voice. And, you know, that makes sense in the context of what we've already talked about with, you know, your upbringing and your own story. But that aside, why is that important to you or why do you think that needs to be done?
Well, the way I grew up, you know, when you grow up like that and you see everybody in the district struggling, you don't have to be Einstein to work out there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And when I started going to the theatre then in 1976, I then became a bit ferocious in the sense of I would get the black taxi down the Falls Road with my wife, usually, ex-wife at that time, and a bus facing Europa up to the Lyric or the Arts Theatre. And I would try and see every play I possibly could. I wanted to suck all that up. I wanted to be good at this. So I watched as much theatre as possible, which I tell young people today. And the point you were making was what?
Articulating the working class voice.
Yes, so I saw all these plays. You'd have Julius Caesar 1 minute, which is my favourite Shakespeare play. And then maybe Oscar Wilde's a gentle comedy. Then maybe George Bernard Shaw. I've actually mentioned two people who had a socialist perspective, but a lot of the other plays would be plays that I thought amounted to nothing. And I thought, well, I can tell them about my ma. Tell them about drama. I can tell them about the hunger rats in the 30s. I can tell them about kids growing up in Turf Lodge with nothing. And that was a passion then. Mm-hmm. That was a passion that I wanted to, that was a wrong that I wanted to write.
Yeah.
And now it didn't always stay like that. Over the years, of course, I thought the first plays that I wrote would be a clarion call to the revolution. That after five plays, it would be a 32-county Socialist Workers' Republic.
And single-handedly.
Yes. And I soon found out that that's all mad. And so over the years, whilst I still have at the centre the notion of articulating the inarticulate or the unvoiced, I'm not driven by any particular ideology.
Yeah.
And I'm about putting people on the stage, communities on the stage. And that's how it has transpired over the years.
Absolutely. And I guess like in that, you know, you mentioned at the start, you're able to not only just write about the characters you see around you, but you can also then just pull them into the roles. What challenges did you run into then whenever your plays start to be performed elsewhere? And maybe, you know, actors aren't people that you've grown up with and they aren't aware of the dialect and they're not sure of certain words or how to say, you know, pronounce things in the way that you would like them to. What was that kind of experience like?
Well, I want to go back just a wee bit to the fellowship. My main problem in the fellowship was drink.
Right.
You know, these people wouldn't, they thought they had to get drunk to go on stage and things like that. So the ground chaperone on a lot of that. When I moved to the Lyric, I was then, some of the Lyric people on the board saw my plays in the group theatre, the first Turf Lodge ones. And then they appointed me resident playwright in September 1980. And I was halfway through a play called Dockers. And they said, we'll carry on. And I wrote Dockers. And Dockers is probably just about my family life. You know, my father, my grandfather, my brothers. When I mentioned my own work record earlier, that was all permeated by days at the dock, you know, in between employment. I'd spend 2 months at the dock or the summer at the dock earning, because the dock's a casual system and you get employed by the day. So I knew the docks inside out. And I wrote this play. And then big cast, about 10 or 11 in the cast. And the first week of rehearsals, I couldn't hear the Belfast accent in any half-accurate way. There was a few who were okay, but quite a number of the actors had spent the last 10, 15, 20 years eradicating, maybe if they did have a working-class accent. And so all the tenets of working-class dialect at that time, like not using the G's at the end of coming, going, being, we say coming, going, being, not saying bright, right, nice, but saying bright, race, right, nice. Those things weren't there. Mm-hmm. And I had to call, that might be minor things, but at the time I was also trying to capture the culture of the dock, and that included storytelling. And the storytelling had to be right. Like if a docker's story finished with a line that says, that's coming through nicely. That was the punchline. I'm fucked.
Yeah.
My reputation or street cred in the docks, that anybody who came to say would say, Lynch had played with a load of shite. So I had to stop a director after the first week, Sam McCready. Sam McCready was probably the biggest influence on me as a writer. And I had to say, Sam, let's get this dialogue right. And we worked on it, and everybody was told they had to get it right. And it did get right. And dockers came to see it in their droves and loved it. Working people came to see it. A lot of the people who were coming to see my previous five or six plays in Turf Lodge and around the clubs of West Belfast all went to Alaric for the first time.
Wow.
So this was a brand new audience that Alaric had never had. I mean, large numbers of them. Dockers was sold out, came back and was sold out again. People shouting up in the middle of the auditorium. People smoking in the auditorium, bringing their drink into the auditorium, breaking all the conventions. And the secretary of the Alaric Theatre at that time, a lovely woman called Winifred Bell, was turning her hair out. On the opening night, she came to me, Martin, could you get your people to stop smoking? I said, my people? Is that my people? So that's and that was a great night. It was a standing ovation, and I was what you don't get nowadays, or I've never seen it before. I'm not a theatre person, so I don't know the protocol, but I was called up on stage to say a few words, and that was incredible. The atmosphere just electric. I mean, people have written about this besides about the opening night of Dockers, and that of course was great encouragement for me to continue. The other thing was that I got £2,000 a year for being writer in residence, which I think was about £84 a week, £81 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to sign off the dole, which I'd been on. I signed off box 32 on the Falls Road to pick up my wages at the Lyric Theatre that Friday. Muriel Molly insisted that I come to the Lyric and stand on the line, collect my wages in an envelope, along with all the actors used to come between, I think, 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock on a Friday at the Lyric to get their weekly wages. And I'd find myself standing on the line with Stella McCusker or Louis Rolston or people I essentially didn't know hardly, and collect my money and go and buy books for the first time.
Class. Martin, we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'd love to kind of end with...
We only got them a first play.
I know. But here, that's the... We'll need to do about 10 more of these to get through the biography. Zooming out then, all right? I do like how we kind of... You know, we made it to the open night of Dockers. That's further than I maybe thought we would get, so we did well. Zooming out and looking at everything, though, out of everything, you know, along the way, what was the hardest moment, or what was the greatest challenge, and how did you overcome it?
There's probably two greatest or strongest challenges throughout my career. Was one, earning enough money to keep myself afloat as a playwright. I remember in the early, let me say this. I was on a dole twice. Once in the mid-80s after the Lyric money stopped, was on a dole for about maybe 6 months. And then in the mid-90s, I was on the dole as well for another 3 or 4 months. Other than that, I have earned some sort of a living as a writer, producer, or in later years, producer and director. So earning a living in the 80s and 90s was very tough because there wasn't money coming in and I had bills to pay and all the rest of it. And I used to run around thinking maybe I should go back to robbing banks or post offices or something like that.
Yeah.
Just to ease things up. The second thing would probably be, and I know people might be annoyed at this, but as I formed a theatre company, so I formed a theatre company in 1990 called Point Fields, maybe a bit earlier than that. And we put on plays by Gary Mitchell and McCafferty, Hugh Murphy, myself, and others. And then in around the early 2000s, I formed a company called Green Shoot Productions. And I felt that...
And after the John Hughes quote.
Yes.
Ah, nice. That's one of my favourites by him, actually. Class.
I am the green shoot waiting for the... or asking for the flower.
Mm.
Actually, Ian McElhenney did a play about Hewitt, and he called it that as well, as far as I remember.
Because there's a slab in Writer's Corner outside St. Anne's Cathedral on the ground that has
yes.
I am the green shoot asking for the flower.
Yes, yeah. I put that there.
Did you?
As I created Writer's Square. And well, yeah, anyway, doesn't matter. The biggest challenge was not getting consistent support and respect from the Arts Council.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my biggest challenge from 2000 to this moment till today.
Yeah. How about the greatest success?
Depends what you mean by success.
Whatever way you want to take it.
I've loved the fact that, for instance, with Green Shoot, which is a not-for-profit, that we created at least a couple of plays that will be getting done here in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Chronicles of Long Cash, Two Sore Legs by Brendan Murphy. Both of them did the Edinburgh Festival and did brilliant. And even just to get two shows like that, there's probably one or two others, but to get two shows like that, that I think will stand the test of time, because a lot of theatre companies come and go and they never achieve that.
Yeah.
The other big successes would be the commercial successes, like Cuts and Shoes, the George Best story, The History of Troubles According to My Dad. But I mean, you know, History of Troubles is probably the most successful play in Northern Ireland, maybe ever. I'm talking like Donald Trump now. But in terms of box office, in terms of it's done regularly and over and over and over and continuing to fill the Grand Opera House, it has an extraordinary lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about Lynch's Corner.
I had nothing to do with it. There's a plaque on the wall of John Hewitt Bar saying Lynch's Corner, and then a quote from one of the plays. It's from a guy out of Castles in the Air, Razorblade. Based on a wee man who used to drink in the club in Turf Lodge, he used to come walking over to me every half an hour when I'm sitting there to have a drink, and he'd be waving his arms about, and he'd say, "Martin, if work was any good, the wealthy would be doing it." And I just, the way you're just carrying on talking, and then you hear that, and you go, "Wow.
Whoa."
I'd say, come over and say, we Martin, it's the banks. The banks. Sort out the banks. On the way back to his seat. But what was that about? What were we talking about there?
Well, let me ask you this then. If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a pint to Lynch's Corner and the John Hewitt, who would you take?
From Northern Ireland, dead or alive? Wow. John Hewitt himself would be a great one. Tommy Geehan, who ran the outdoor relief strike in 1932, would be another one. Betty Sinclair, who was 21-year-old leader of the outdoor relief strike. These would be my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Buck Alec would be another one. I would love to sit down and talk to Buck Alec.
I mentioned the Lions at the start. What was that true?
True, absolutely true. Our Seamus saw them.
Wow.
Walking along York Street, tied with two big ropes, two lions, sometimes one lion. And you know,
teeth or no teeth? Because I've heard different versions of the story.
What's that?
Did they have teeth or no teeth? Because I've heard a few versions.
Oh, they had teeth. I was speaking to his granddaughter recently, who lives in Los Angeles, would you believe it? And she says they all had teeth. The teeth were extracted. But they were generally older in their years.
Aye.
They didn't have a lot of fair in them. Like, for instance, my dad says there'd be boxing bills in the Ulster Hall or the York Rangers Club down in York Street. And the first fight would be Buck Alec and the Lion. So he'd strip to the waist, get into the ring, and start wrestling the Lion. But the Lion wasn't interested. So he'd whack it in the ribs, and it'd do a big roar. And their crowd were roaring cheer. So you had to wag in the ribs to get any life out of them. They weren't very ferocious or anything like that.
Man, you mentioned the 18-hour play. I think we could do an 18-hour podcast. There's so much to chat about. Just to kind of put some sort of a tail on it, I usually end with this. Bit of a cliche, but I just think if it's not broke, you know, why fix it? If you could go back in time, you know, say to an 18-year-old version of yourself, none of this time travel nonsense. Don't give me the, don't want to do anything in case it, you know, makes the universe blow up or whatever. But if you had a couple of minutes of an 18-year-old Martin's time, what would you say to him?
I'd be saying, do it now. Go for it now. I didn't get the confidence to really produce and take control of my work until I was in my 40s, my mid-40s. And I regret that. I wished I had the confidence when I was 18 or 19 or even my mid-20s.
Unreal. Well, for everyone listening, whether it's live here now or later on the podcast, I want to say thank you so much for spending this time with myself and Martin. Really hope you enjoyed the time. I had an absolute blast. Really want to say thank you to the Out to Lunch Festival for making this possible and for inviting us to do this and for giving us a space to do it. And other than that, Martin, I just want to say thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure, and I hope it's the first of many chats, because there's plenty more I'd love to talk to you about.
Thank you very much, Matthew, but you've been a great Bomber Gascoigne.
Awesome. Thanks very much, everyone, and hope you have a great rest of your day.
Hi, everyone. I'm Claire Dowage, GM of Ormo Baths, a tech hub and co-working facility based in the historic Victorian bathhouse in the heart of Belfast city centre. Back in the good old days, Best of Belfast was my commute entertainment. Listening to the inspiring stories of Northern Irish people following their dreams and making magic happen was a great start or end to my day. Now that I've been working from home, I've kept up the same routine, and it's a great way for me to continue to brighten my days. My favourite episode, well, it has to be from one of our dear members of our Ormo Baths community, Mr. Mark Todd. It was really inspiring, and it just made me feel very peaceful, at rest, and happy knowing that there's excellent people doing excellent things within Northern Ireland. It is our delight and our pleasure to have Best of Belfast based out of the Ormo Baths, and we're excited about what's coming next. So, if you've been on the fence about joining the Producers Club and would miss Best of Belfast if it wasn't here, I'd highly recommend you joining today. Pop on over to bestofbelfast.org, and I look forward to seeing you in our WhatsApp group very soon.